First of all, you heard about the Ananda Yoga classes that are going to be given. This Ananda Yoga is a system I created. Yogananda used to have me perform the yoga postures. I'm far from being able to do that now. But when I was young, I was lithe. And he had me always perform them for his guests. And so I feel that it was under his influence that I created this system of Hatha Yoga, which was not a this will slim your hips, girls, kind of yoga. Its whole purpose was to show that there's a connection between the body and the mind. And when you bring the two into harmony together, your health is better physically and mentally. So to show how your physical postures and how your physical attitudes and so on can affect your mind is the essence of this particular kind of yoga. Second announcement. I have asked our singers to become available to sing in churches and colleges and schools and anywhere they can and want to, and we must ask our publicists to help make them known. So if you can think of any venue where you would like to have this music sung, I have to say that just a few days ago I got the opportunity, if you want to call it that, to be present at the Grandfather's Day. I'm not the grandfather, but I was there at the school of a couple of children. In fact, Bharavi's two beautiful children. And I was absolutely appalled at the kind of music they sang. It was so ego-centered. And I would like very much to have a different kind of music sung. You know what happened? Why I ever even stepped into the arena of writing music was I was up at Yosemite. This was many summers ago, in 1974, I think. And I always have had a somewhat good voice, and so I like to sing. And I saw a couple of young boys singing quite badly with their guitar on the railing of a bridge. And I came up to them, I said, well, would you like me to sing? And they said, oh, yeah. I mean, they were relieved. And so I sang, but I didn't know what to sing because I studied singing, but the songs that I sang were all in German and Italian and so on. So anyway, I ended up singing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And for some reason, they loved it and said, you just got to come and sing for our party tonight. So I went to their party, and I sang, and they were all thrilled. And as I was driving back home the next day, I thought, well, music would be a wonderful way to share with people. I had been thrown out on my ear by SRF for trying to be creative, and they don't like creativity there. And so I didn't break any rules, I didn't break any commandments, I didn't do anything wrong, but they didn't like my creativity. And so as a result, I was off on my own, but I didn't want to get revenge. I wasn't interested in that. I just wanted to continue serving my guru. And so what I did was look for ways in which I could serve him without competing with them. And as I was leaving, I thought, well, song and music, this isn't something that they offer. So maybe I could go around the country singing. And I thought, then what am I going to sing? O cessate di piagarmi, o lasciatemi morir, which sounds great in Italian, doesn't it? But the real meaning is essentially, stop bugging me and let me die. I thought, well, this is not quite the message I want to give to people. And I couldn't think of any songs that I knew that really would give those messages except Indian bhajans and master's chants. But those are not the sort of thing you can sing in public auditoriums. Suddenly the thought came to me that maybe I could write my own. And the moment that thought came to me, there came also the inspiration for a song. And I liked the song. I sang it over and over, and I stopped at a milkshake stand and wrote it down on a paper napkin. I know how to write music, so it was not a problem. And when I got home, I found that my brother had left his Martin guitar at my parents' home. I was staying with them at the time. So I got Pete Seeger's Folk Singer's Guitar Guide or something like that and began studying it. And I kept on writing songs. They kept coming to me. Somebody has asked the question, what was I going through when I wrote this song and that song? I have to say I didn't go through any of it. It was not a personal statement. It was something that I felt inspired to sing or to write. But I wrote several more. And later that same month, it was August, somebody heard me and said, well, would you like to give a concert at the Unitarian Church? So I said, sure. I mean, you have to understand the level of stupidity that it took for me to answer that way. I hadn't been studying even a month. But I decided that after all, at least it will force me to practice. So I practiced like mad for a whole week. Anyway, when the evening came, the hall was filled with 200 people. They turned the lights out to create atmosphere. They had a candle burning on the mantelpiece behind me. And if there was one thing I desperately needed, it was to see those strings. Anyway, with this minor handicap, I was able to sort of carry it off. And in fact, the thing was a success. And somebody afterwards said, you know, those are pretty some pretty interesting chords you were playing there. I said, yeah. Quickly changed the subject. And so I kept on writing, and by now I have written over 400 pieces, including a string quartet and lots of things. It just was given to me. I don't know how else to explain it. For example, at one point, I began feeling frustrated because the melodies would come just like that, but then I had to work to get the words to rhyme, and the lyrics were difficult. And they had to say something in as short a space as possible and be intelligible and so on. But one day I decided, well, I've always loved Shakespeare, so let me write some of his songs, his lyrics. And I wrote 18 of them in 3 days. That's how quickly these things came to me. And the string quartet is considered the most sophisticated kind of music to write, but this string quartet tape came out beautifully. I do urge you to listen to it if you can. And I went to the Holy Land and felt the different vibrations of the different places. And when I came home, I wrote this whole oratorio that you're going to hear on Saturday. And so my musical career, although it seems to have been casual, has actually been a very central part of whatever mission I may claim to have brought to the world. And I'm very happy with it. I'm very pleased that we're going to have singers going around singing these songs. Now, my third announcement. This will be a great one for you. We have a boy who just graduated from our Education for Life university, and he has a degree in Education for Life. And he's been teaching at Ananda School for the last 2 years, and they say he's really a good teacher. And he has agreed to come down here and start a school. And I think this will be... I think this will be a fantastic opportunity. We have, you know, the theory behind Education for Life is that we don't want to train people to become good job holders or successful businessmen. We find that that will come up, as a matter of fact, just by being aware. But our concentration has been to prepare them for life, have the right attitudes. I have read, for example, that if you're a boss, show your authority sometimes, slam the door, shout. I say that's just a sign of an immature personality. And we have taught our children how to act in such a way that when they transfer from our school to another school, they're almost always leaders in the new school, outstanding students. We always pass nationwide exams, whatever they are. We always come out in the top 5 percentile. So the system works, and I'm very happy to be able to bring it to Los Angeles. I think there's a desperate need for a different kind of schooling. And this school that I went to, at least it says that there can only be 15 students to a teacher. I very much approve of that. This thing of just teaching from a podium to a crowd of people, that's not the way to get things across to children. So in every way, I think this is going to be really a great blessing. And now to my subject. Oh no, first I have to sing to you. Well, all right, bring it over. This is a song. There's a beautiful story about it. It's considered the first song in the Italian language. They always used to sing in Latin before. And St. Francis wrote this song. And on his deathbed, he was singing it. And Brother Elias, who was a sort of thrustful monk there among his disciples. And he came in and said to him, "Holy Father, you know these people think of you as a saint. What will they think if they hear you singing on your deathbed?" And St. Francis said, "Forgive me, but I can do nothing but sing." And so he sang this song. And it was a song with which he died also.
Altissimo, onnipotente, buon Signore, tue son le laude, la gloria et l'onore, et ogni benedizione, a te solo se confano et null'uomo è degno de nominarte. Laudate sio Dio mio Signore cum tutte le tue creature, specialmente messer lo frate sole, la quale giorna et illumina nui per lui, et ello è bello et radiante cum grande splendore de te Signore porta significazione. Laudate sia mio Signore per nostra terra la quale ne sostenta Et guberno et produce diversi frutti et colorati fiori. Et colorati fiori et erbe. Laudate et benedicite et benedice mio Signore et ringraziate et servite a Lui cum grande humilitate, cum grande humilitate.
Thank you. This song, it's interesting, because when I wanted to write this melody, I tuned into St. Francis, and this is the melody that came with that song. And what is particularly interesting is that Donovan, when he wrote the music for Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, which incidentally is a lousy movie, he tuned into the same melody. And he didn't get much of it, but he got the beginning of it. Brother, Sun, and Sister, Moon, Altissimo, Altissimo, mio Signore. See, it's the same beginning. And then he went, Brother, Son, and Sister, Moon, I long to hear you, long to hear, hear your tune. Dead beginning, dead ending. La, 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 la. But at least the beginning was inspired. You could hear it. And it's the same melody. I really think that we both tuned into the original song of St. Francis. I can't swear it, but it's an interesting piece of evidence. Now then, today, finally, we get around to our sermon, such as it will be. Concerning Orthodox religion in America, the Master said it needs improvement. Its present focus is on training the ministers intellectually. They learn to speak well, but they don't meditate or try to attain spiritual realization. In our churches, the ministers are committed, above all, to their own self-realization. When I appoint someone a minister, I look first to see what degree of spiritual progress he made in a former life. Master then declared very seriously, "We are on the eve of a great change in the churches. Real seekers will go there. The church will become a spiritual laboratory where people will be encouraged to test the teachings they receive and to judge for themselves what works and what doesn't work, instead of accepting emotional declarations of untested dogmas." Now, this is a very important point. We are right now on the cusp of a new age. Sri Yukteswar explained these ages, and it's a very interesting thing to contemplate. It's not only India who developed the system which Sri Yukteswar revived. Something like 200 or 222 other ancient countries believed that there were four yugas. The Greeks believed there was a golden age, a silver age, a bronze age, and an iron age. The Persians had the same belief, but people all over the world. It makes you realize that there was another knowledge, a knowledge that was more universal than we imagine it. We imagine people having come up from a hunter-gatherer. I've always hated that expression. Hunter-gatherer state to the state that we know in history. In fact, the earliest states that we know in history were a period of degenerating knowledge, degenerating understanding. Back 700 BC was when we entered the last dark age, and it was a downward cycle which reached its depths at 500 AD, and from then on began to come up. Now, Purushottama and Vyasa, Steinmetz, exactly, sorry, they have written a book. They just finished it, and it's a very interesting book on these different cycles of time. But they've analyzed and shown how, as in the descending cycle and then the ascending cycle, at that part, see, in the coming down like this, these parts, where we began to lose the knowledge was the same part of the ascending one where we began to reacquire that knowledge. It's absolutely fascinating. My own interest in school was particularly ancient civilizations, and I wrote my paper on that when I was in high school. So for me especially, it's been interesting. But in this system, it shows how man gradually comes up to the point where he discovers that matter is not the solid thing that people thought it was. Matter is really only energy. We have entered this age of energy. And a niece of mine told me that this word energy is something you hear all the time these days. But we entered this age only in 1900 AD. We entered a bridge period into it in 1700. And from 1700, you see a complete change of civilization. You see new machinery being built and new ways of looking at things and new ways of doing the work and so on. And in 1905, they discovered that matter doesn't exist as matter. It really is only energy. And from now on, in this age, people will conquer the delusion of space. And already we find that people have been able to go to other planets, and they haven't reached the planets yet, but they've reached the moon, and some of our spacecraft have reached Mars. But in this age, which will last another 2,000 years, we will find that man will be able to go to distant places and space will cease to exist. They will find it's possible to go distances that science now tells us are not possible for man. It would take too long. But my guru explained that there are shortcuts which will make it possible to beat the time a zone that they tell you you can't go faster than light. You won't have to go as fast as light. You just bypass light. It'll be altogether unimaginably different. Then the next phase will be a phase where they conquer the delusion of time. And that will be called Treta Yuga. Dvapara just means second. Treta just means third. But in this one, which lasts 3,600 years, mankind will be able to see into the future, be able to communicate without words, be able to see people's real meaning instead of what their words are declaring. You won't be able to hide yourself the way people can now, pretending to mean one thing, but really meaning something else. In that age, people will see through you. They'll know. But one very interesting thing about that age may be seen in And there are a couple of ancient books that were written in India regarding the future, which was a descending age. And in that book, they describe the lives of people who weren't yet born. And in that, I discovered a section of that book. It was very interesting. It said that in my last life, it spoke about my living in the time of Kurukshetra. Not my last life, another lifetime ago. The reason it went further back than one life, because it usually gives your last life, your present life, your future life. And I had already gone to a reading of this thing in Varnala in Punjab. So when I found another segment, it said I have already given him a reading in my Yoga Valley. So then it said a person has many lifetimes to live. And in the time of Kurukshetra, he lived as a ruler of a small kingdom, and it went on and talked about that. And of course, there's not much I can do to prove anything of that one. But in this lifetime, it said his father named him James. Well, my full name is James Donald Walters. So he was quite right. It said he was born in Romania, which certainly for somebody visiting India would not be usual. He grew up in America. He had brothers, but no sister living possible, although one will die in his mother's womb. And I asked my mother when I went back home if she had had a miscarriage. She said, yes, she'd had one. And it went on to talk about things. I believe I talked about this last time. It's a fascinating subject. But anyway, in this yuga, all time will be demolished. You'll see that time and space, movement, they don't exist. They're just mental concepts. And then in the highest age, that will be an age when people will understand very much more easily that everything that we see around us is only a vibration of God. Now, as we mount toward that kind of understanding, we begin to see that God cannot be the kind of God that people have imagined so far. Most people, when they think of God, think of him as he is in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel with a long white beard, or behind the chapel altar in the Sistine Chapel, which is even worse. There God is condemning the damned. And you see him with his expression like this. All his energy going to those poor people who are in hell, whereas the saved people are sort of, glad we made it this far. These are barbaric concepts. And most of our churches teach barbaric notions of what God is all about. I have to say that when I was young, I had grown up in this kind of church. It wasn't fundamentalist, it was Episcopalian, but I just couldn't stand that kind of image of God. And I was really seeking truth. And I sought it through physics, through astronomy, through science. Then I thought, well, that's not changing me. What I find out about the world scientifically, what does it do for me personally? What's the use of a truth that leaves me untouched? And so I thought, well, maybe political systems. And I thought of communism, thisism, and thatism. And I saw that people can't be changed by systems. Systems depend on people. And it's how people are that makes a bad system work even. And so I abandoned that. I said, this can't be the answer. And I thought, well, then what must God be about? What must truth be about? It has to be something that affects me. And so I turned to the arts because I saw that they could affect people's feelings. But I saw that the arts can affect them in a good way or in a bad way. And I thought there's got to be something more than this. And the more I thought about it, the longer I... Because I remember in college, my roommate, he was from Argentina, and he said to me, "Can't you stop thinking?" You must say I was a very peculiar young man, but I just was thinking, what can life be all about? And for me, it was a very serious thing. To me, it was life or death kind of thing. And if I'd used love, I'd have found him quickly. But I was going by intellect, and that's a slow path. But fortunately, my intellect took me in the right direction because I was honest about it. And I remember this one night, taking a long walk out into the night and asking myself, if there's a God, what must he be? I realized he has to be consciousness. And if he is consciousness, then I am a part of that consciousness. And therefore, let me try to see if I can be more aware of that consciousness. Because I found that when I was more in tune with that broad universal consciousness, I was happier. And I was less in tune with it, perhaps if I had gotten drunk or something, I was not happy. And so I decided that what I have to seek in life is God. And I determined by my peculiar path that the only thing worthwhile, worth doing in life is to seek God. And then the thought came to me, maybe I'm going crazy. Because who ever heard of anybody seeking God before? I had never read the lives of saints. I didn't know there was such a thing. And the thought of, I had heard the word, but I thought a saint was probably some kindly old gentleman who patted little children on the head and helped little old ladies across the street. And that was about the most I could imagine. And when I thought that I was doing something this unusual, I thought, maybe I'm going crazy. And I remember going out into the countryside and thinking what I need is just the beauties of nature. They will inspire me. And I went out and I tried to enjoy them, and I'd look at the beauty of the sunlight on a raindrop. And I'd say, yes, this rainbow effect and so on, it's beautiful, but I can't feel it. What's the matter with me? I felt like I was a motor working on only one cylinder. And I thought, no, I've got to change myself. And God helped me out. God does help you. When you raise one hand to him, he drops two to you. And I remember him. I remember how my father was sent to Egypt by his oil company to explore for oil. The day I put my mother on the ship to go join him, the very day, I went uptown New York and I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And that completely changed my mind. I took the next bus across the country. I came to Yogananda. I said, I want to be your disciple. And he gave me his unconditional love and asked me to give him mine. And he asked me to give him my unconditional obedience. Desperate as I was to be accepted, I still had to be truthful. So I said, but sir, what if sometime I think you're wrong? He said, I will only ask of you what God tells me to ask you. And then I said, in that case, I give you my unconditional obedience. And that was over 62 years ago. But I think that what I went through then, many people are going to start going through as they realize that the old model doesn't work. The old person who's up there waiting for his chance to gleefully throw you into hell, it doesn't work. Why should God create us and then create all the temptation to make us fall? And then when we do, he gleefully throws into hell. It makes no sense at all. Not only that, but to have dogmas that you don't question. People are coming to a state of consciousness now in their greater awareness of energy, of realizing that it's not enough to be told things. It's not enough to be made to believe this. People used to believe the world was flat. That didn't believe didn't make it flat. I want to experience truth. I want to know it for myself. Man won't have to evolve to this point just by accident. This is something that is being pushed toward by the change of vibrations in the planet on which we live. And I have noticed over the 61 years that I've been teaching that there is a marked growth in spiritual understanding among my audiences. As I was saying in the yoga teachings, we've gone far beyond that idea of this will slim your hips, girls. It's a teaching that makes you want to understand who you are, how your body can affect your mind, how your mind can affect your body. These are important things. We want to experience truth. And when I went to that Titans of Yoga premiere out in Santa Monica a few weeks ago, I was thrilled to see how also yoga is being taught in a new way, with new understanding, much more depth, much more practicality. The kind of questions people ask me now show much more awareness than they did 50, 60 years ago. This period of time is not very long. A human lifespan is very short. Nonetheless, it has been long enough for me to see these changes. What I have noticed, because I wasn't in Los Angeles for many years, about 50 years, coming back here now and living here now, I've noticed that there are two directions that people have taken. It's sort of this way. Some people are going downward, others are going upward. What we are coming to today is a period of serious crisis. This crisis is being felt first in the economy. Mind you, this economy is not going to get better. The government is telling you lies. This economy is headed toward a very serious depression. Much more serious than the last one. People will be starving to death. It will be caused by their avarice, caused by their negative attitudes. And you must realize that this is not a temporary blip. It's going to last a while. There is one solution, and God inspired me to create that solution long ago, to create places where people live together, work together, grow their own food together, and take care of one another. I had this idea, I think I was born to do it, because at the age of 15 already, World War was raging in Europe, and I had this idea of creating communities where people could live this way together. And I have an enthusiastic nature, and all my friends were enthusiastic until they found that I was serious, and then they all left me. But I really seriously wanted to start communities. And when I traveled around the world, I would visit. I visited a kibbutz in Israel. I visited different places where people lived together. I tried to understand. I talked with people who were good at economy and economics and so on to try to think how to make such a place viable. But I was seriously thinking, how can I bring this about? It was a part of my search for God, for truth. How can people learn to live together? I said, if you can get a few people living together and setting a good example for others, they will do much more than they will by accomplish much more than they will by writing tracts. And so I very seriously wanted it, but then, after all, at the age of 15, what can you do? I couldn't really do anything. And so I put it on a shelf and thought, well, let me learn more before I pursue this. And then when I came to Yogananda, because in him I found the culmination of everything I had been seeking for. Mind you, it was not his personality. It was the principles he represented. He was much more than a human being. He was humanity perfected. All the qualities that we love in people, I found in him to perfection. I follow him as a man, but I follow him also for the principles he represented. To me, he represented the perfect human being. And in following him, I found that he also had this ideal of starting communities. Now, his followers, his disciples, his other disciples, I should say, they didn't like his idea. They were against this community's idea. And after he died, they removed from his autobiography any mention of communities. He had written as a name and ideal that this be one of the ideals to start world brotherhood colonies in every country in America, in the world. And they said, they changed that aim and ideal to read only to awaken a spirit of brotherhood among mankind. A spirit of brotherhood is not a community. Honestly, I've just finished writing a book. It's called Rescuing Yogananda. And it's one of the most important books I have written. I know many of you have read it, but I've added 45 pages to that book. I've rewritten it completely, and I'm extremely satisfied with this book now. But it does talk about the wrong directions that his own disciples have been taking his work. One of the wrongest is their refusal to admit that he did want to start communities. It was a strong thing. I remember a Mrs. Myers had a garden party in Beverly Hills. And there were some 800 people, including many Hollywood celebrities and so on. And you know how a talk is usually when you are the honored guest at a party, and then the hostess asks you to speak. You say thanks to the hostess and thanks to the guests and thanks to everybody, and isn't it been a nice day, and isn't it been just wonderful? And if you're a spiritual person, you add a few spiritual thoughts and pat everybody mentally on the head, and that's that. You go back to your cup of tea. Well, I tell you, this is the most shocking talk I have ever heard in my life. Yogananda got up there and he said, "This day marks the beginning of a new era, and these words shall not die. My words are sown in the ether, and my truth shall not die." And then he went on to talk about how thousands of youths must go north, south, everywhere. Nirmala one time was reading this thing at the holiday, at our service in Ananda Village, and she was reading, "And thousands of youths must go north, south, east, west." I said, "Give me that book." And I read it the way he'd really said it. My goodness, it would have blown your socks off. In my whole life, I have never heard such power in a lecture. It was thrilling, but it showed the intensity. "This day marks the beginning of a new era. My words shall not die, they're sown in the ether." And for SRF later to have claimed, which they did and do, that he changed his mind, it's just too absurd for words. I mean, Master was a man of truth. He sowed his thoughts in the ether and then, "Oh, well, I guess I changed my mind." It's too ridiculous. I said to Dayamata, the president one time, when are we going to start these communities? And she said, frankly, I'm not interested. Well, I was interested. And God gave me the opportunity because I didn't want to compete with them. I wanted to do something that was harmonious. I've always tried to work with them. I've never tried to get even with them, even though I think they treated me terribly. But I feel that I'm unhappy if I hate people. I don't know how to hate people. I've never had that emotion. But I know that I'm happier if I love them. I know I'm happier if I forgive them. And so I've always tried to be harmonious. And I even offered to give Ananda to Dayamata. And she didn't accept it, fortunately. But I must say that this idea of communities, I decided before I began Ananda to create one, and there was only one person whom I could find who was interested, and that was me. I had relatives tell me I was losing my mind. I had people tell me it's absolutely impractical, you'll never do it. I had people say, many people have tried to start communities in the past and they've all failed. I just decided that I'm going to make it happen. And I had to, first of all, earn all the money myself. So I gave yoga classes around San Francisco and I charged $15 for each class or $25 if they took both Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga. And I became fairly well known, and I had something like 300 students a week, and this brought it around to being an income about $50,000 a year, which back then, that was quite a few years ago, but in the 60s, that was worth quite a bit of money. And so with this money, I built Ananda. And once Ananda was built, then people began moving onto our land. Oh, the troubles hadn't stopped, no. It was the hippie era, and many people were on drugs, and I insisted there be no drugs. And many people were, what particularly irritated me was that we had a mortgage of $1,700 a month, and I came up to the village. I was down there earning money, giving more classes. And I came up and said, well, look, can you all help me build, earn this money? Oh, they were outraged. I mean, here we're living for God. What living for God meant to them was going down to the Uber River and swimming all day. It was particularly galling that I was actually fulfilling their expectation that God would take care of them by doing all the work. And so anyway, we did gradually develop a good, solid group. Jyotish and Devi were among the first. And I was so grateful to them. People who wanted to do something positive. And with Jyotish especially, I have to say, without him, I don't know how I could have succeeded. It was with his help that we got everything moving. But bit by bit, I began to attract people who wanted to do something positive and who didn't want to just leap down my throat every time I made a suggestion. They didn't want authority. I remember having to say to one boy, Dick Sisto, Dick, I did not start Ananda to turn it over to you. And that was sort of the attitude that, well, I'd given this very beautiful place, but now it was theirs, and they'd do with it as they wanted to. And as far as drugs went, oh, all right, they wouldn't take them on the property, but off the property, it didn't matter. And I had to make it absolutely clear that I meant everywhere. You have to be off drugs or you can't live here. And that took a certain amount of determination, but I was determined. And so no alcohol, no drinking, and no dogs was basically our only rules. And the reason for the dogs was that we had a dog named Blue, which used to chase people and chase the newcomers and chase the deer. And they had a committee there. And if you want to win out, you have to give on certain points. So they insisted on self-rules. So I said, okay, rule yourselves. I knew that they'd get nowhere, and they got nowhere. It took them 5 years to reach the conclusion, finally, to get rid of this dog, Blue. And so they took it far away and left it. It was nobody's dog. It had come on as a stray to begin with. And it was really not so easy to get a community going. But I have to say, this is the best thing that Ananda can offer. We can offer a model. Once you have a model established, then you can say, this is how we do it. And people will say, oh, if that's how you do it, okay, we'll do it that way or we'll leave. So in the beginning, there was no such model. And everybody was there trying to create the model. And it took a lot of patience and a lot of difficulties and a few obstacles, like a forest fire, which destroyed most of our land, almost all of our homes. And poor Devi had just given birth to her first and only son 10 days earlier. And here, everything they had was taken away from them in the fire. It was a big test for the community. We've had several big tests, but somehow we've come through. I remember with that test, there was a beautiful thing that Jyothish contributed. People, we didn't have insurance, fire insurance, so we had to somehow tough it out. Incidentally, to show how important to us the principle of dharma is, I wrote to the... It was discovered that the cause of the fire was a faulty spark arrestor on a county vehicle. And our neighbors were all saying, we can sue the county and get all our money back. And I wrote the county and I said, I know you're worried about us because we're the biggest losers in this fire. But I said, I want you to know we're not going to sue you. We don't want to take our bad luck out on our neighbors. And so we had no fire insurance and refused to sue for the money that we could have gotten back. We could have gotten $2 million back. We refused to do that. But we flourished. And the next day, there's a beautiful picture of Asha clearing the land. There's Asha's here today. And she is a beautiful photograph of her clearing the land of all the blackened stuff and so on, with a big smile on her face. We were happy all the time. And our neighbors, even 10 years later, were grieving as to all the things they had lost. Right attitude makes so much difference in life. And so we have been through our tests. 50 people left then. And Jyothish said, let us pay them for their buildings first. They too had lost their buildings. And so I agreed, let us pay those people who were leaving the community first. Most communities would have said, well, let them go starve. We'll take care of ourselves first. But as the donations came in, which thank God they did, we paid off those people so that they could leave happily. And then we started concentrating on rebuilding our own homes. We were and have been strictly dharmic. We follow the path of right action in everything. And as a result, we have flourished. But this, now I can say, we have been there for 42 years. And we are a wonderful success. But the most wonderful thing is that we have hammered out a way of life which we can proudly declare does work. People can now, in this depression, if they want to follow our model, it will be much easier, as it has been easier for other communities that have been started in other parts of the country and the world We have 8 communities in all. But all of them have been easier to start because the pattern has been hammered out and they can say, this is how we do things. Nobody argues. If that's the way, if you know what you're doing and this is what you're doing, all right, well, we'll do it that way or we won't do it that way. We'll leave. But they were not in the formative stage anymore. Now we're coming to a time economically when the world is going to be shaking severely. I mean really severely. There will be mass starvation. There will be great suffering. The future of it will be good. People will be much more spiritual. People will not be thinking so much of depending upon the almighty dollar, which they will find is no longer almighty. Master said that this dollar will someday not be worth the paper it is printed on. And I read a financial newsletter recently which said that a hyperinflation can occur even in one day. It doesn't have to be a gradual thing. It can occur very suddenly. I think we are on the verge of this very serious time. So seriously, do take my words with all the serious intent that I can put into them. Try to get land in the country. I don't want everybody to come to Ananda. Where would we put everybody? We could put up quite a few. We'd be happy to have many people. But if you, for example, if you follow another religion, or if your interests are somewhat less spiritual than ours, still, if you follow our way of life in the sense of the specific rules that we've developed, which are virtually none, but traditions we have many, you will find it's much easier to start a community. And Master said that this ideal would spread like wildfire. This will be a going back to the land movement, which will have real punch in it. Do take these words seriously. It will affect religion also. People will no longer be satisfied with mere promises. They will want to know, does it work? And in this, yoga works. Yoga tells you how to calm your mind. Yoga tells you how to concentrate your mind. With the practice of yoga, you can make a better businessman. It's not just good for yoga, for going off to the mountains and being a hermit. You can practice yoga and become more effective at anything you do. I wrote a book just a few months ago, 180 pages in 2 weeks. People can't do that sort of thing. How can I do it? Because I practice yoga, because I have that divine grace that just wrote itself. I didn't have to wonder what was going to happen. It just came. But anything that I do with such concentration that sometimes people say I work too hard, but in a way I don't work at all. Because he's the one doing it, I'm not doing it. You will see that you will be able to weather this storm and you will come out the other side of the tunnel with much more integrity, much more peace of mind, and much more dedication to ideals in life. You will begin to take life more seriously. It will no longer be the cocktail party life. It'll be a life in which you will take seriously. What is God? How can I feel him in my life? How can I feel divine guidance? Religion is going to change. It will become a much more beautiful thing. And maybe many of you can be ministers going around to such churches, spreading this gospel of experience over blind, dogmatic belief. Well, I see I've already talked 10 minutes beyond my time. And I must give you time also to ask your questions. So do you have any questions? Yes.
Hello, it's Rhea with the cows.
Hi.
Hi. I was looking for communities because I, for a while now, I've believed that this is where people should be.
She's been looking for communities because for a while she believes what you've been saying.
I mean, tears were coming to my eyes. And there are communities, intentional communities, San Francisco, San Diego, Phoenix, but nothing really around here.
I'd like to start a community here in Los Angeles.
So would I.
I must say that I suspect the cities are going to be wiped out in a war.
Well, yeah, I know,
I'm
I
afraid.
Agree. But
however, that apart.
But, no, seriously, but maybe...
Other than that.
Maybe to
you know,
start.
When countries, when there's absolute desperation, people look around to see where they can take their money from. There's likelihood to be war, world war. And, of course, with some over 30,000 known atomic weapons being stockpiled, I doubt that it will not be an atomic war. I think that a war may be very short-lived, but very fierce. I do think that will be in our future, too. The country is a safer place. But would we like to start one here in Los Angeles, meanwhile?
And
well,
I...
we are starting one. This house is one. This is an ashram, and it's a place where we have several people living, not related to each other, and I would like to have other buildings around, and in time, just as I want to start a school here. I mean, you have to know the future, but you have to work with present realities, and this is our present reality. I would like to start one here.
Okay, we'll talk after. And if anybody's interested, why don't you stay after? I already have kitchen things, and I really want to be with like-minded people,
think?
Devotional She's people.
Asking people to stay after to talk with her. About
okay.
It. You can work with, right behind you is Durga. She's been at Ananda for a long time. She lives here, so you can work with her.
Yes. Cool. Okay. Any other questions? Have I knocked you flat? Yes.
Yes. I find that it's difficult for me to resonate when I'm reading simply the writings of Yogananda. I'm always more connected, more inspired to hear you interpret the teachings and to write. I'm very grateful for that. Any comments as far as why I resonate more in the present than the words that Yogananda wrote?
What's he saying?
Why does he resonate and understand the teachings better when he's in your presence and you explain them than just when he reads them from Yogananda?
Well, you know, he taught me to teach. He gave me that job. And of course, when I talk to somebody, I try to talk his language. And so in doing that, I can reach you in ways that most of his writings, Autobiography of a Yogi, I think must have reached you, didn't it?
I read it. I attempted to read it a couple times, but I could not get through it.
Well, I'm amazed. To me, that book was the greatest book in the world. Anyway, the truth is that I do speak modern English, and I do I do speak clearly, and so all I can say beyond that is that I'm grateful if I do reach you. But I don't repeat my words from anybody else. They're my words from my experience, and the teachings are his, but they're put in my way. And I have spent many years trying to think, how can I make this teaching so clear that nobody can say, I don't understand. And I worked very hard at that. And he told me, you have a great work to do, because I think he saw that this was my particular gift. So yes, I do try.
Thank you. And I hear it.
Oh, back there by Ted. Oh, sorry.
I just want to comment on that. For me, I think sometimes because you have a deeper understanding or the depth of what Yogananda was trying to say, it's like you're interpreting another language almost, because I know I've read a few things and I thought I understood what they meant, but then you've made your comments on what Master really meant and it made total sense to me. So from my standpoint, I feel that you just have a deeper understanding of the points he was trying to make.
Well, it's true. I have spent 62 years trying to think, how can I put this to people so they really understand it? I feel that he put it very clearly, but he did put it with a Bengali accent. He did speak in his particular way, which my way, and this is partly why he depended on me. And he said, you have a great work to do, as I said. But that has been my tendency. I'm, you might say, the editor. I take a thought and I think, how can I put this in such a way that it makes absolute sense? I've had in the past a great fault. That fault has been doubt. Any thought, any proposition that was given to me, I thought, is it really true? And so, you know, as when you break your bone, you form a bone around it that is of a different substance from the bone itself. It has more strength. So also when you have a fault and you overcome that fault, the new consciousness that comes with overcoming that fault is a stronger thing. It's a virtue. And so what I have found is that my tendency to doubt has brought me, I don't have any doubts now. That's from past lives. But in this lifetime, I have reached the point where all those questions that I asked, that I've answered. And finally, I've understood in a way that most people don't feel the need to understand. But to me, I do feel that need. So that if there's any loophole, I've got to find some way to plug it. Got to find some way to answer it. And what has been my greatest failing has now become a virtue. So I'm grateful for that. And I may as well enjoy this final release from that doubt, because as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, the doubter is the most miserable of mortals. And I think that my problem has been that I have suffered. As you know, when you find doctors concerned for people's health, that's because they probably, it's because they knew ill health in other lifetimes. Psychiatrists, well, the same thing. Some of them seem half crazy already. And so, in my case, my doubts were spiritual. And I've had this really, I have to say, intense longing to help people to understand. It's not just been a casual thing with me. It's been a deep longing. Any other?
Hi. I'm new to Ananda, but I've been reading books written by Sylvia Brown and her spiritual teachings.
She's new to Ananda, but she's been reading books written by Sylvia Brown.
And in one of her books, she did mention that community living is in the future, and that's the direction to go. And I wanted to know if you're familiar with her books, and can you comment on her spiritual teachings? And do you agree?
Are you familiar with the book, any books by Sylvia Brown? She talks about communities in them. And
no, I am not. You might like to give me one. I'll pay you a premium. No, I'm sorry, I'm not. Any other? Yes.
If time is just an illusion and everything has already happened, does it really matter what we do?
Go ahead.
If time is an illusion and everything has already happened, does it matter what we do?
Well, yes, it does, because it makes your future no good. But the thing is that back in Treta Yuga, they knew that you would have that rebellious thing and decide you didn't want to do something. So God is omniscient, and you can decide to wear a yellow tie this morning. What makes you make that decision? You can decide, I want to go out and get drunk. My parents told me not to. I've never done it, but I'm going to do it just to show that I can do it. What makes you decide that you want to do it? It's not your willpower. We're not free. What makes me want to cross to the other side of the road? Because there's something inside that makes me want on that particular day. And these impulses that we have in our past that come up from countless incarnations ago, we're a bundle of self-definitions, and we need to somehow get rid of all those self-definitions by realizing that, no, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not the other thing. But those definitions piled on top of each other make us think, this is who I am. You are not who you think you are. When you get through to who you really are, you'll realize that that's a beautiful thing. I've written this book, The Time Tunnel, and it takes people forward and backward in time. And in the one that takes them forward into a time of enlightenment, you see that everybody has a different kind of house, a different kind of way of life. Everybody is different. And you think, well, how come? You know, we try to be different, and we are imitating, even in that. When you want to be different, then you finally reach that point where you don't have to be different, and you realize that you are different. The beautiful thing, Yogananda said, that God is Satchidananda. This is what Shankaracharya said many hundreds of years ago. Satchidananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, and Master added the definition, ever-new bliss. That bliss, the wonderful thing about it is that it's always new. It's always individual. Master wrote an autobiography of a yogi. He said that every atom is dowered with individuality. And when you get down from all the definitions that you've given yourself, which are in reaction to the world around you and have nothing to do with the real you, when you get down to the real you, you will be unique in the entire universe. Each person is himself. You'll notice this about the saints. Every saint is himself. And every saint is different. They all love God. They all have wisdom. They all have certain basic things in common. But each one expresses it differently. Look at Sri Yukteswar and Master. Here, Master and disciple. And the disciple was almost the opposite of Sri Yukteswar, who was all jnana, wisdom. And Master was all love and joy. And inside they were the same. But in their personal expression of the infinite, they were unique. And you find that Master was very different from most saints. One thing I loved about Master was his absolute humanity. He was perfect in his humanity, but he was so human. He could go out and mix with all kinds of people. Many saints, they avoid people. He didn't. He was a friend to everybody. And I remember one time this function where there was this Indian who was a little tipsy, let's say feeling no pain. And he was treating Master jovially in a way we wouldn't dare do, throwing his arms around him, "Hello there, Bali." And a Bengali friend of mine said something to him, deprecating in Bengali. Master said, "Don't." He respected the man. He respected him as a soul. And if he wanted to desecrate that image by being drunk, that was his business. But he saw the God in all of us. I remember because I when I was young, I suppose I looked a little like Jesus with my beard in a day when nobody wore beards. Anyway, I was asked to play a part of Jesus in a play, a silent play, pantomime. And later Master said, many were saying that you looked like Jesus. And I said, sir, well, I thought this would make him smile. I said, well, I'd rather be like Jesus than look like him. And Master didn't smile. He reacted quite seriously. He said, that will come. He always saw everybody in terms of his potential. One time he entered a hotel, I think it was in Minneapolis, and there was this drunken person who came over to him and he put his arms around me. He said, hello, Lord Jesus Christ. And Master saw that he was not quite there. And he tried to give him a little taste of bliss. And the man sort of reared back and said, hey, what are you drinking? Master said, well, it has a lot of kick in it. But he left him sober and wondering what had happened. So Master was absolutely, he was charming in his humanity, but he was completely himself. And some of his disciples tried to make him over into the sort of image they thought he ought to have. They've actually edited his laughter out of his talks, in his spoken voice. And certain jokes that he told, they've carefully removed. One time on his last birthday, there's a recording of Dr. Lewis whispering to Master about the candle on his birthday cake. Do you think you can blow that out? And Master said, I think there's a little breath left in me. I just have to be careful I don't blow the cake away. And they took that last thing out, thinking it didn't sound dignified. Well, if they want a cardboard saint, let them have him. But he was no cardboard saint. He was absolutely wonderful, but all his humanity was humanity in perfection. I never saw him display a single human fault. I never saw him angry. I never saw him jealous or sad or unhappy or anything. Always it was just that perfect equilibrium. But I'd look into his eyes and I'd see there was no ego there, no thought of self. When you get rid of your ego, that's when your true divine self comes out. And it's not the same divine self that everybody else has. It's your way of expressing God. Okay? Any other? No, we don't have time for more questions. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Great to be with you.